Welcome to my stories and journeys where the river flows. And this river is Avon Wisk, the Usk. So last episode I began my walk by going to the source of the Usk and ending at the first bridge, Pont ar Wisg. And in very short order after that, the Usk meets what you might call her first major intervention in the form of a reservoir, Cronfa Wisg. The reservoir is surrounded by the trees of Glasfynydd Forest. The line of the county boundary between Breconshire and Carmarthenshire, which the Usk carried so faithfully, now continues right across the reservoir. We're still in wild and remote landscape. The reservoir is a particularly good place to stargaze at dark skies. It's a popular place for anglers. And last time I was here, they had just released new stocks of trout into the water. And there were already a couple of young lads brewing tea on a little fire at the water's edge and fishing and diligently putting their catches back into the reservoir afterwards. And watching them from high above was a magnificent circling osprey. Ospreys have started returning to the Usk Valley and there are a breeding pair establishing downriver near Talabont-on-Usk. From here, the whole length of the river downstream has been designated a special area of conservation and a site of special scientific interest, which makes it all the more perplexing and disturbing that the Usk is suffering so much from the effects of pollution. For me, meeting the reservoir here is an introduction to a whole world of how we use and control river water. It's a fascinating enough process, though it can have quite a daunting vocabulary. For example, the waters of a river are referred to as being impounded in a reservoir prior to eventual controlled release. Impounded. Maybe we could think of a different word. Maybe if instead of impounded we said something like held in trust, it might encourage us to begin thinking about water and our river differently. Apart from the water going to Swansea from here, there will be releases, topping up the river in hot weather, and abstractions of many varieties as the water flows on, siphoning it off for various uses. And it feels a bit as if that process begins here at the reservoir, even though we're only a few miles from the source of the Usk. You might say that here, her first moorland wildness is brought to a halt. And wondering about this brings in lots of new thoughts about the journey that lies ahead, for the Usk and for me as I try to follow her. As far as I can tell, the Usk on leaving the reservoir is a pretty similar size to when she entered. She's heading east now, and I follow her as she makes her red-brown way on a bright May morning. She's still not so very big in size, but when she leaves the reservoir, she isn't on her own for very long because there are a number of smallish, busy tributaries keen to join her. And the first of them is the Henwen. Ah, it's a familiar name. We met Henwen, the old white sow of legend, in season one of Around Goes the Rambler, as we made our way through Gwent where she farrowed strange abundance in the wheat fields. And now here she is, on the Breconshire stage of her journey, flowing down through her own little valley. And she arrives, pushing her way through a thick tunnel of may trees in blossom to join the Esk. There is a footbridge marked on the map, but it turns out to only lead from nettle patch to nettle patch now, and time has turfed it over into a green platform, home for the smallest creatures. And not so very much further on, up comes the Hudver, who arrives wide and a little shy through banks of bluebells and stitchwort, which is one of my favourite Maytime combos. And here there is a footbridge to cross over, and just beyond it the waters meet. And I love water meets, the sense of joining and returning and flowing on together. And just on from the footbridge, there's a strange little sight, which makes me stop and stand and look at it for quite a while. It's a kind of a melancholy sight, but a good while ago, it must have been, someone suspended a tire swing above the river. But the children who swung out there, kicking their legs over the river, must have grown long since. And the tire now is crusted in deep moss, and the rope that suspends it is wreathed in lichen. And there the tire hangs, just touching the water, as the river swiftly and softly flows on. Now, on this stretch of the river between the reservoir and Brecon, there is not a continuous path, and it's a case of picking back and fore and making little loops where paths allow, and sometimes, yes, looking longingly through the gates of private estates, and also doing a bit more tramping along the verge of the A40 than is strictly ideal. And journeying in May is wonderful and one of the most special months to be out walking. But nevertheless, it does throw up a few extra little challenges because the leaves everywhere that are bursting green make thick screens in front of signs and stiles and turnings, and rampant foliage is busy engulfing lesser trodden paths that you often find yourself seeking out as you try to weave little bits of river access together. Yes, you get sent off down many old lanes and byways in the search to get beside or even in sight of the river. But some of these enforced detours can hold special surprises too. And I was making my way towards Pont Pantyscallog, and I'd had to take a route above the river and above the A40 through a very overgrown nettly lane. And as I came round a bend, there, suddenly crossing the path in front of me, was a little trickle of water, not even a stream, just a trickle, making its own way down the hill to the Esk, and as it crossed the path, it had made a small, gritty red puddle, and drinking from the puddle was a fox, and I was near enough to see its tongue lapping as it stood on slender legs. The fox lifted its head and seemed to look in my direction, but carried on drinking unconcernedly. And I stood watching a while longer, and then the fox lifted its head again, and even though I hadn't moved an inch closer, this time it saw me and startled and went running off ahead on along the track. And so I was glad to think that I'd been quiet and still enough to go unnoticed for a while at least. What an unexpected blessing to see a young fox drinking from a red puddle in the middle of a riotous green lane in the middle of May. Approaching bit by bit, by the time I get to walk beside the Usk at Sennybridge, she has changed. She's been joined by a couple of substantial tributaries, the Cry and the Senny. And this sets me wondering why, when one river, in this case the Usk, is joined by a river that is pretty much the same size, such as the Cry, the river that flows onwards from that confluence takes one name, the Usk, and not the Cry. I decide to squirrel this question away because in Brecon I'm going to meet someone who would be a good person to discuss it with. In any case, swelled by the Cry and the Senny, the Usk is a river to be reckoned with. A wide, steadily journeying body of water that I can walk beside, past hazel and beech, past the military camp, top secret, do not photograph. Yes, the Usk has grown fast and beautiful. And on she flows, and on I go, following her where I can. And she is joined again and again, smaller streams and rivers running up with their news. The Camlice and Nant Bran flow neatly into the now stately Usk. Because she is stately now, the Usk, with islands and shallows and stretches that go bubbling over boulders. In this day of comings and goings to the river, I found myself in the late afternoon standing on the river bridge between Trallong and Skethrog, and here I saw the Usk had grown wide and still as a mirror. She was full of tree, sky and cloud, green, blue and grey. Looking down, I could see a few inches above the waters a pulsating veil of tiny insects circling and looping. And below again, little ripples told me there were fish there, even if I didn't glimpse them. And the world in the water mirrored this one so neatly that it was easy to sense an other world below, stretching away beyond, beneath, beside this water mirror. What if there should be just a fleeting glimpse of a figure moving there? What if something called me on an errand into that world, as it has called so many in story? The Usk, on that May afternoon in that place, was indeed a mirrored way, an entrance to somewhere where everything was and was not just a reflection. Whereas I stand and watch, the other world brings itself into being clear as daylight for a few precious moments. Well, I took some of these thoughts into my dreams that night where they dived and swam. And next morning, I made my way on to Brecon to meet Alan Bowring, who is the Geopark Development Officer for Banau Brycheiniog National Park. And he is a lover of rivers. And we sat talking about many matters, strange and familiar, by the banks of the Usk.
The Usk flows mostly almost wholly over a rock which we call the Old Red Sandstone. So these are sandstones, a collection of sandstones and mudstones that date from what we call the Devonian period. So the rocks themselves are between 420 and 360 million years old. They're actually laid down by a river that probably looked a little bit like the modern day Indus or the Ganges in South Asia. What we know from the geological record is that there was a monsoon climate, there were big mountains to the north, and these rivers were draining those mountains and flowing to the sea to the south of us, where Devon is, hence the name Devonian period. And it was the sand and the silt and the mud that the river dropped off over the course of its flow down towards the sea that subsequently became the sandstone and mudstone of the Old Red Sandstone. And now modern day Usk River is eroding into that that rock that was laid down all those hundreds of millions of years ago. So it's a grand recycling scheme in a way. When you see the river in flood, you see the river turning the colour of the rocks, and that's because they are carrying those rocks as tiny little particles all the way down to the Bristol Channel. And those sediments are being laid down layer upon layer. Eventually they may turn to rock, and they may be thrust up into the air as mountains in 200 million years time, and the whole process will begin once again. So what we're seeing now is just a moment in time, you know, the huge expanses of time that are geological history, deep time we like to call it, and we're just here for an instant and seeing those processes in operation. Today it's the Usk. All those years ago, well, it was a river that didn't have a name, or at least our species didn't give it a name, and the same will be happening into the far, far future.
So I've been trying to get to know the Usk, and as I've started walking along the banks, I've discovered that there are layers and layers of complexity of what knowing a river is, or even beginning to know it. And I know that this is something you've been pondering over for a while. So how's your journey with the Usk been so far?
It's a long journey. I mean, for me, it's been 19 years so far, getting to know it bit by bit. It'll take another 19 and a whole lot more beside that, because I think you've got to be out in all the seasons, haven't you? Different weathers, different company and so on, seeing the different moods of the river, and it's always got something new to show.
I was delighted to meet a fellow source seeker, but it's not as easy as it might first appear, is it?
Oh, it isn't. I went on a bit of a mission to find the sources of a number of different rivers locally, the Usk being one of them. And sometimes it's quite clear, it's marked on the map. When you actually get there, that may or may not be as obvious as the map suggests that it's going to be. Particularly after drier periods or wetter periods, the river might be shorter or longer than you expected it to be. So I've certainly found myself casting around thinking, well, is this little tributary, this little rivulet, the true source, or is it that one over there? So I'm not sure you ever get a certain answer, but, you know, the journey's, it's all part of the fun.
Who decides the official version?
Yeah, isn't that a good question? I guess the Ordnance Survey, when they first set these things down on maps in the early part of the 19th century, that kind of settled things in a way. They were doing their surveying, they were asking particular people in the community, but they didn't ask everybody, and some people might have had a different view. So we typically look to the Ordnance Survey, I think, as arbiters of these things, but they're not always right.
I was thinking about how the tributaries join the river. You know, I just get the overwhelming urge to go and kind of follow all of them, each one back to their source. I haven't got enough years of my life left for that, I don't think. But I was thinking, with the river, really what you're following is you're following the valley that's the home of the river. For example, when the Cry joins the Usk, I was thinking, well, why is it the Usk and not the Cry? Because the Cry looks nearly as
big is the Usk?
I mean, when you look on a map, whether it's the catchment of the Usk and its many tributaries or another river system, sometimes you think they've got that wrong. And I guess some of it's accidents of history or who spoke with the loudest voice and lived in a particular area. It's partly about possession, isn't it? You know, naming a river gives you some kind of possession of it. You know, I mean, there's examples, aren't there, from around the place. You know, one of the tributaries of the River Thames is actually longer than the Thames itself. I think it's the Cherwell. So why isn't that the Thames? Geology's got a part to play. I think it's a significant part. So it's a mixture of kind of, I don't know, what do you call it, natural and cultural influences. You know, we've obviously applied the names, but the rivers have been flowing pretty much continuously since the end of the last ice age. I mean, there would have been rivers around before the last ice age, and obviously during the ice age for a few thousand years they were rivers of ice, although you might have had an actual watery flow beneath the ice itself. And in fact, as a geologist, I mean, I'm aware that the ice age actually diverted the course of various rivers. You know, so the top end of what we now call the Gaveni, one of the tributaries of the Usk, that used to start out in the Llantoni Valley and flow through what is now Llanfihangel Cwcorni, but now it's diverted into the Mono, and that was the ice that actually blocked off the valley. So the whole business about rivers being dynamic over long periods of time, short periods of time as well, you know, a single flood can make a difference, as can an ice age, as can a 100,000 years. So nothing is static. It's a very dynamic thing.
I've discovered I really love the places where the waters meet, where they join one another. There's something so special about that. I always get a kind of a lift, a sense of joy when I see the rivers meeting. It's like old friends. I don't know what it is, but the meeting of the waters is good, isn't it?
Oh, there's a sense of occasion with any confluence, I think. I mean, I was down at the confluence of the Gaveni with the Usk just this morning, just looking into the water, pondering. I've been down there and an otter has been peering back at me before now. So it's a place where other animals hang about as well as humans. But it's a place for contemplation.
There's something as well fascinating when there's a waterfall and the falling water meets the river. I always find that completely mesmerising.
Yeah, we're lucky, of course, in this part of the world, aren't we, that we've got a multitude of waterfalls. Not so many on the Usk itself, but some of its tributaries have them. And again, it's a sense of, you know, I talked before about a dynamic environment. I mean, those are rivers at their most dynamic, aren't they? Where the water's falling over a ledge of rock. And again, going to them in different seasons, you know, the winter storms, when those falls are in full force, you know, they really are, well, they're literally forces of nature, aren't they? Most impressive places to be. And they do something for us, don't they? They lift the spirit, they impress us, they fill us with awe. Worth seeking out.
Definitely worth seeking out. Not always easy to seek out. The rivers, and the Usk included, are by no means easy to walk alongside for any length of time.
No, I mean, the Usk, there are sections where you can accompany the river for miles at a time, and there are other areas where you will just intermittently come across the river where it's bridged and there's no public access. I mean, in a way, what that does is to allow parts of the river to remain in peace and not be disturbed by us. If we were in Scotland, of course, the law is different there, and there's a general right of access to the countryside as a whole. You know, responsible access, of course. But we don't have that in Wales or in England.
Yes, I was very aware of so much of the river, actually, miles and miles, not just places that are privately owned, so keep out, this is private fishing or whatever, this part of the river runs through my estate, but also just parts of the river where people just don't go very much, and just the river lives its own quiet life and follows its own path and minds its own business.
Yes, if we look at the Usk, there is not there's not an Usk trail as such, but there's an Usk Valley Walk, and it's so named, I guess, because we are very much experiencing the valley rather than simply the river. And getting away from the river gives us a perspective over it and the valley context, which we wouldn't get if we just simply hugged the side of the water all the time. So it's worth getting that broader context. But yes, there's still places that we'd like to get closer.
From here on, of course, you have got the Usk Valley Walk, and from here on you've also got, well, the canal. Mm. What's the relationship between the canal and the river?
Yeah, the canal's been here for just over a couple of hundred years now. And the canal, in a way, it is the river. And what the canal is doing is borrowing water from the river, and then it's returning it to the river further down. Some of that return is via leaks, so it's an informal arrangement. And we've had a problem in recent times when the flow of the river, because we've had a little rainfall, the flow of the river has been insufficient to be able to sustain the canal as well, because each time a boat passes through the locks, there are several thousand gallons of water consumed. And of course, that's, you know, the busy season is in the summer, when there's likely to be least water in the river to feed the canal and to pass through the locks. And going forward into the future, that could be more and more of a problem. They've existed side by side now since the start of the 19th century, both very much treasured by people who live in the area and people who visit. You know, it's the canal's an artificial thing, and much as we've come to love it and there's plenty of wildlife on it, it does affect the way that the river behaves, and that's something that we've got to reckon with for the future. We've got to find a way, and it's going to be tricky, but we've got to find a way to keep the river healthy, or indeed to return it to health, but also to keep alive the gem that the canal has become.
After I said goodbye to Alan, I took thoughts of river and canal and deep time and sandstone and water meets for a walk along the Gurkha path, which runs for a couple of miles from the promenade alongside the river. The path was restored and is maintained by the people of the Nepalese community in Brecon. At the end of the last episode at Pont ar Wysg, a pair of swans came and flew over. But this time, on the far bank, it was the most beautiful blue-grey heron that stood there watching the water until it lifted its slow, wide wings and flew away on downriver. Thank you for keeping me company on my journeys and stories where the river flows. And I'll see you again on down the track.